Things are changing swiftly in higher education these days. At the moment, Oregon is dealing with the pending temporary shutdown of all public schools because of the coronavirus outbreak, but issues in higher education obviously predate the outbreak. Concordia University in Portland announced a few weeks ago that it would close down permanently at the end of the academic year in the spring. That's the third private institution of higher education to close in the Portland area in 2 years. The situation raises questions about the economic issues facing colleges, private and public. We explore those questions in this hour. Three guests join us. Linda Schott is the president of Southern Oregon University. Linda, thank you for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Jim Pinkert is with us as well. He's the director of the Office of Post-Secondary Finance and Capital for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, or HECC. And Dr. Nathan Graw joins us as well. Welcome to you, Jim Pinkert, by the way.
Thank you so much.
Nathan Graw is with us as well. He's a professor of social sciences and economics at Carleton College in Minnesota, and he wrote a 2018 book called Demographics and the Demand for Higher Education. Nathan Graw, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let me put the economic discussion off to the side for just a moment, because Linda Schott, I want to get an update from you about coronavirus issues on campus. Some announcements made yesterday, longer spring break, out of classroom teaching as much as possible. Has anything changed since yesterday? Because so much seems to be changing so fast.
No, nothing has changed on our end. There is discussion at the state level about the impact of the closure of the K-12 schools. But at this point, SOU is continuing with the plan we laid out yesterday, staying open and moving as much as possible to remote delivery.
And how prepared are any of the instructors, or is there just the basic infrastructure in existence for that kind of remote learning?
Our provost feels that we'll be able to make the transition. Not everything will be online. It may be done through video conferencing or some other technology. Our Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Learning is gathering resources and already thinking about how to prepare faculty members to make that transition. And that was a key reason for us to extend spring break for students by 1 week, because it gives our faculty a little bit of time to begin thinking about how they offer their courses in a remote format. We're not the only university doing this. Everybody is having to make this transition. So there are a lot of resources now available from other institutions to help us think about this as well.
So you moved the end date of spring break, but not graduation, I understand it. So we're trying to cram, what, a 10-week quarter into 9 weeks now?
Apparently, I've learned there was precedent for this back in the late 90s. I don't remember. I think it may have been the flood in Ashland that caused the problem. Mm-hmm. And there was a way that they used to compress the campus, the term. You can do it in a variety of ways. You might eliminate finals week and fold it into regular mm-hmm. class time, or you can extend class periods, especially if it's done remotely. You can just extend class periods by, say, 10 minutes each day or something like that.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good point you bring up about the flood on the first day of 1997. It certainly caused some disruption in the Ashland area that went on for quite some time. So, yes, there is precedent there. All right, let's move on from coronavirus and talk more about the general realm of money and higher education. I want to bring in Nathan Graw here, because the trend lines in the population group of people who generally attend college is not looking good for colleges, is it?
No, certainly there's a regional pattern here. So the Northeast has been experiencing this for a while. But in 2008, with the financial crisis, we saw a dip in fertility. And because kids get older approximately 1 year at a time, for higher education, we can anticipate a pretty significant decline nationally starting in the mid-2020s as we work through the declining fertility that we've recently experienced.
So the drop in fertility caused by what again?
So the financial crisis represented a lot of economic uncertainty, and certainly if you were on a college campus, you experienced that in the way that college budgets were affected. But young families also experienced a lot of economic uncertainty, and that seems to have precipitated a decline in fertility. But we're not entirely sure why it is that decline has not only maintained at lower levels, but actually continued to decline through at least now 2018.
All right, so a continued downward trend, not just
exactly.
So there wasn't a bounce back up again after the Great Recession.
No, in 2014 we had a very slight recovery before the downward slide continued. The numbers for 2019 are tentative at this point. It looks like maybe we're not declining quite as fast as we did in 2018, but it certainly doesn't give us any clear evidence that we've reached the bottom yet.
Does this speak to a certain level of attrition? I mean, with fewer people of college age attending college, then does it stand to reason that some schools will die?
To some degree, I think it's not quite that simple necessarily, because as we're seeing in response to coronavirus, institutions are capable of adapting to new environments. Certainly, when we see a decline in the number of young people, that doesn't make it easier for colleges, especially small independent colleges, to survive financially. But on the other hand, by adapting with new methods of teaching, by reaching to new student groups, we can mitigate the decline in the number of prospective students by appealing to a larger number of students.
All right, we'll pick up the demographic discussion in just a bit. I want to get into the relationship now between the seven state universities and central entities here, because the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is not like it was, Jim. Is that right, Jim Pinkard?
Well, that's correct. I mean, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, as it currently is in statute, didn't exist prior to 5 or 6 years ago. The institutions were governed before by the Oregon University system that had been in operation since 1935.
All right, so it's been a de-evolution here, essentially. So do each of the universities then go to the legislature with their own requests?
They do not, and I'm glad you asked that. So the Higher Education Coordinating Commission is not a governing board. We are a coordinating commission, and that is a little different. Many other states have this model of higher ed governance, in that we collect all the information that is needed to present a collective and, we hope, coherent budget request to the state legislature on behalf of the higher education infrastructure in the state. So
Jim Pinkard, we were just talking about the way in which things are done now that the seven schools are independent with their own boards of trustees. You're not a state board of education at HEC anymore. You're a coordinating commission. So they don't go to the legislature individually. They come to you. Give us a little idea of how that process works. Does each school come up and make a presentation, or how does that work?
Typically, no. So we have our agency budget request that goes to the state legislature. Included in that request is a level of funding for all seven of the public universities through what is called the Public University Support Fund. So all of the state financial support for these institutions flows through that Public University Support Fund. And so that's a piece of our budget request to the legislature.
Linda Schott, describe what it's like from the university end, though, about how you have to prepare your budgets and your indications to the legislature through the Higher Education Coordinating Commission of what you think the needs are at SOU for the next 2 years.
Well, it's particularly challenging during the long session of the legislature, because they often don't approve the funding for the Public University Support Fund until the very end of the session. So in those years, we may not know until well into July really what the appropriation is going to be. We have to set tuition rates in March or April. We want our students and families to know what they should be prepared for the following term. So we have a tool that we use that allows us to estimate all of our costs. We build in estimated increases in costs, as well as what we think our estimated revenue will be, and we begin working from that budget.
And how bare bones is the budget at SOU now? And I grant that you haven't been president for that long, but you certainly are able to look back at what used to be.
Our budget is not adequate at this point. I've had long discussions with Jim Pinkard. He understands this. We believe there are issues with the funding formula. It's called the Student Success and Completion Model, and it was designed several years ago. And it really is designed to incentivize certain kinds of degrees and attainment by different populations. We don't disagree with the fundamental principles of the model. We do believe they need to be modified to ensure stability for the smaller regional institutions such as SOU and our true colleagues, Western Oregon, Eastern Oregon, and Oregon Institute of Technology.
Are there certain kinds of things that the smaller schools, again, we're talking, you know, the four smaller schools you just mentioned, and then the bigger ones, Portland State, Oregon State, and the University of Oregon, are they basically held to the same general standard, Jim Pinkard?
Yes, they are. So our intent at the state level is to pursue what we call the 40-40-20 plan. So we have a plan for higher education for the entire state. And we hope that all the universities and community colleges and private institutions as well play a role in the future of higher ed in our state. And so the formula is designed to incentivize completions. We want the institutions to know that the state funding, the public money that they receive, is to help students, resident students of this state, complete a degree that we hope they'll put forward to a very worthwhile career in our state. And so our intent with the formula is the same across all institutions, to support the learning experience of all Oregonians.
And Linda Schott, what would you like to see done differently, though, for the four smaller institutions, SOU, EOU, WOU, and OIT?
The smaller institutions generally do not have the economies of scale that larger institutions have, even though we collaborate with each other in many ways. So we believe that some adjustment in the mission portion of the model would be appropriate, just to enable us to have a little bit more stability. We're still quite willing to compete with others on doing the best for our students, incentivizing their completion. But it's hard for us when we don't have stability. For example, last year, the legislature very generously awarded $100 million more dollars to the Public University Support Fund. Of that $100 million, when it was distributed through the formula, the increase for SOU was about $1.2 million. And the increases that we got from the state in terms of increases to the public employee retirement system were $1.1 million. So that just gives you an idea of the state has costs that we must pay. And in that case, it really didn't keep up with the cost, because retirement is only one of the costs that we have to pick up. So in addition to that, the model was really built to incentivize the production of degrees in science, technology, engineering, and math. And we don't disagree with that, but we'd like to, we believe that other degrees are also important to the state. The state is, at least our region, is worried about a shortage of teachers, particularly in rural areas where communities are experiencing difficulty getting police officers, mental health counselors, and those are the kinds of degrees that SOU does really well and yet are not incentivized through the model.
We were talking about higher education and higher education funding here on the Jefferson Exchange with Linda Schott, the president of Southern Oregon University, Jim Pinkard, the director of the Office of Post-Secondary Finance and Capital for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, or HECC, and Dr. Nathan Graw, professor of social sciences and economics at Carleton College in Minnesota, who wrote a 2018 book called Demographics and the Demand for Higher Education. You can join the conversation here on the program, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So, Nathan Graw, as we get into some of the issues facing colleges, is it partly what Linda Schott is talking about, that the emphasis on STEM means that the liberal arts colleges in particular are having some struggles?
I think there are pressures on defining the value proposition of the liberal arts degrees. I think the research and the evidence suggests that students can succeed regardless of their degree program. So some of this is messaging, and some of it is that colleges and universities can do a better job of making connections between what students are studying and their lives after college. I think the students who are taking STEM courses see those connections a little bit more readily. But there are a number of great examples of institutions that are demonstrating that you can draw those connections clearly for students in all areas, including the humanities.
Are there some examples that you have top of mind for yourself, colleges that are doing this particularly well?
So I think there are a number of ways that institutions do this. So, for instance, you can look at Drexel University or Northeastern, and they have signature what they call co-op programs or internship programs. And these are a large footprint way to make these connections clear so all students will have a term-length internship before they graduate. Other institutions, however, are leaning into internships, but not necessarily with quite that same footprint. Or they're looking at other ways. So, for instance, Scripps College, just down the coast from you all, which has a long tradition in the humanities, is rolling out something called the Public Humanities Program, where they've adopted a model, frankly, from a STEM institution for what they call clinics, where the model they're drawing from is a clinic in business, where you have a real business problem, and then students who have training in economics would propose solutions to that problem. Here they're identifying problems that humanity faces, things like homelessness, the environment, and they're asking their students who have studied humanities programs and humanities programs to identify what humanistic answers to these pressing problems are. And of course, you know, the problems that we face are multifaceted, and so there certainly are STEM parts to the solution, but there are also so many important lessons to be learned in the humanities.
So something incumbent upon the university, you're saying, to make the case that the stuff they teach is going to be useful in the world today.
Well, I think that's always the case. I think as we've moved through the financial crisis and beyond, students and their families are perhaps a little bit more attentive to costs and benefits, and so maybe they're pressing us more in this way. But I wouldn't say that that higher ed has ever lost sight of the fact that what we're engaged in is providing an investment good. Families are investing in their futures. And so we need to continue to adapt as we have in the past. We need to continue to ask what the future requires differently than in the past and how we need the curriculum to change. But I think that's true in the STEM fields as well as in the non-STEM fields.
Is it just more incumbent on universities generally to make that case given how much more higher education costs than it used to?
I think there's something to that. We've seen both in the public and the private sector institutions an increasing pressure on family budgets. And I think whether we like it or not, parents are going to remind us that we need to make that value proposition argument, that we have to explain to them why their students should attend our institutions. As a faculty member at a private institution, we often do hear the pressure of, well, why should I attend the private institution that has a higher, at least, sticker price? When there are lower sticker prices at public peers. And, you know, certainly I imagine that in the public sector there is a similar need to explain a price tag which, while it might be more modest than at some other private institutions, is still a hefty price tag for many families to get their heads around.
Does it feel something like a death in the family at a private college like Carleton when you hear, like, of Concordia in Portland and Merrillhurst before it shutting down?
To some degree, I think it's a sobering reminder that while institutions do have long and storied histories, your history isn't what determines what happens next. We have to re-earn our reputation every day, and we have to remake the argument with a new cohort. One of the great things about being at a college campus, whether a university or a private college, is that there is this turnover. In the undergraduate class, it's every 4 to 6 years. You have an entirely new batch of students with a new and fresh perspective, and that's, you know, that brings energy and it's life-giving. But it also reminds us that every 4 to 6 years, we have to remake the arguments we made before. Whatever your success was 10 years ago, that's not these students. That's something that you accomplished in the past, and you need to redo it or find new ways to do it all over again.
Higher education funding and health, the topic here on the Jefferson Exchange with Nathan Graw, a professor of social sciences and economics at Carleton College in Minnesota, Jim Pinker, the director of the Office of Postsecondary Finance and Capital for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and Linda Schott, the president at Southern Oregon University. Jim Pinker, would you talk about the evaluations that HEC is required to prepare on the institutions for the legislature?
Certainly. So in statute, every other year we're required to do what is called a university evaluation. We typically structure it so that we do the four technical and regional universities in 1 year, and then every other year we do the three larger public universities. And so the university evaluation, though, includes a lot of components. It speaks to their finances, their academic mission, the number of completions, degrees. They're rather lengthy. They're on our website for those interested in seeing them, but they run to 40, 50, 60 pages in some cases. They are truly an intent to evaluate soup to nuts, A to Z, the entire institution.
Well, so have the criteria been consistent for the SOU, for example, has been evaluated three times now, is that right?
I believe that's true, yes.
Okay, and have the criteria been consistent each time? I mean, they haven't changed over the course of that time, I'm saying.
They have not, in a significant way, as I understand it. I get involved on the finance side. Dr. Veronica Dujon and her staff do a lot of the other heavy lifting on the university evaluation. So my component is very slim, and so I can speak to the finance side of it. It's been consistent over time.
All right, so let's talk about the financial ratios, because the Composite Financial Index, or CFI, that comes out of the university evaluation for SOU shows some concern for SOU this time around. The desired benchmark, as indicated, would be a 3.0 or above, and SOU shows a minus 0.86. What does that mean?
The Composite Financial Index is designed to communicate, using one number, the overall health of an institution, but it's very important to understand that any one, the CFI calculation in any 1 year is not as valuable as looking at the trend over time. And so the institutions, because they've been independent for only the past 4 or 5 years, that trend data is limited to only that small period of time in the evaluations. I think we only have a 3 year period of time. And so our hope going forward is to extend that, and so folks can see that trend. But I think what that means is that that's just indicative of all the challenges our institutions are facing, demographic, through online competitors, through student choice. Students are choosing different fields of study. There are policy challenges. Other states, Washington, California, are making their own institutions more affordable, and so that's affecting enrollments of out-of-state students. And so I think that CFI is just reflective of all the challenges, financial and otherwise, that an institution is facing.
Linda Schott, you've already registered some concerns about the Composite Financial Index. It doesn't look good for SOU, but what is not seen in there that you think should be reflected?
Well, I appreciate Jim Pinkard's point that it's a measure of one point in time. We think that we have to be very careful about the types of metrics that are used, the purpose for which they are used, and then how they are communicated. So we do not disagree with the Higher Education Coordinating Commission's right to evaluate us and to use these metrics. We would like to see perhaps the consideration of whether there are additional metrics that might provide a broader view of an institution, and we're very concerned about how the metrics are communicated. Should they be shared with our boards of trustees, for example, before they're shared with the commission? Should they be shared with the general public? We also think that they should not be shared devoid of context, and the HEC did not do that. The HEC, Jim and his colleagues, did a very good job of presenting to the commission the context around the use of these metrics. It was very unfortunate that the Oregonian picked up on about two paragraphs out of what was for SOU, I believe, a 35-page report, and reported them in the context of an article about the closing of Concordia and program eliminations at Linfield College. It was not the appropriate context for that, and it made people believe that SOU was in danger of going out of business. That's very dangerous for an institution, and I want to be clear to everyone listening that we are not in danger of going out of business. We do have a reserve, and we are continuing to work with the state to help us have even more secure finances.
Linda Schott, you were talking about the way in which the public was made known of the university valuation for SOU. It was in the middle of an article about Concordia University closing down in Portland, and it made it look, certainly, you know, at a glance, like maybe Southern Oregon University was in deep trouble, which you say is a dangerous thing to assume.
It's a very dangerous thing to assume, because folks who are not well-versed in the ratios do not understand what they mean. Ours, for example, includes a liability, 30 years of PERS liability. I know there's one other institution in the state that has a much larger endowment, and their ratios look very good, but they are, in fact, quite worried and are reducing their budgets because of other challenges they face. So it's just dangerous to put out these ratios without any context, and in a way that where people just don't understand them.
You know, given the fact that, again, these valuations have only gone on for three fiscal years, it looks like, since the de-evolution of the Oregon higher education system, with separate boards of trustees for each of the seven campuses, are these measures that are being pulled in for the first time? I mean, are they things that SOU didn't used to be gauged on, Linda Schott, I guess is the big question.
That's correct, Jeff. Under the Oregon University system, the metric that was used was how much you had in reserve as a percentage of your operating revenue. And that is the metric that our Board of Trustees has used. And we have been managing to maintain a 10% ending fund balance, it's called. In the last couple of years, we strategically decided to spend into that fund balance a bit in order to continue the forward momentum that we had established with our new strategic plan. I've already begun a conversation with our Board of Trustees about what other metrics do they want to use. We need to be aware of the ones that the Higher Education Coordinating Commission are using. We need to continue using the one we've used. And then there are people across the country thinking about this issue. There's a new book out, for example, called The College Stress Test, and they look at other factors. So what I want to do with our board is really have a good discussion about which of the metrics will be most informative and can help us ensure that we're steering the institution in a financially sustainable way.
Let us take a phone call in here. Ryan in Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about higher education with Linda Schott, Jim Pinkert, and Nathan Graw.
Well, thank you, Jeffrey. I commend the conversation, as I think you have a great topic here. I would suggest that this happened more regularly because it's a dense conversation. Looking back historically on sort of the utilitarian focus, and I believe this was Kitzhaber primarily, that STEM economic drivers be the almost the sole goal, it felt like at times. And as a STEM educator, it helped me to some degree. But also in terms of equity, access, and community, I think we're missing the mark for student success. Larry Roper was my boss at Oregon State, and Larry really made a strong statement that the success of students really had to do almost as much with community as it did with coursework. And that their lifelong success was, you know, how did they apply their skills, what kinds of things did they get engaged with in the community, very much the private school model. And then NESE bears this out, the National Assessment of Student Engagement. So I think that we've jumped the gun. And I liked the chancellor being the lead person, lead voice in the state for higher education. There were lots of challenges there because it kept getting, you know, weaker and weaker. But anyway, my question really is really about how do we measure success.
Okay, that's a good question. Thanks for that, Ryan. Why don't we take that one to Jim Pinkert, first of all?
Yeah, and I think that's the $64,000 question that I think a lot of states are asking and a lot of institutions are asking, and that also speaks to what is the role that higher education plays in our society. We know that looking forward, the need for post-secondary degrees and credentials and training will increase over time for our citizenry. And so we also know that change is inevitable,
and that the decisions, you know, that students are making, the fields of study they choose, the types of delivery mechanisms the institutions provide, we know all of that's changing, and we know that post-secondary education is not just for young folks. Lifelong learners are going to be encouraged over their careers to come back to higher education and post-secondary training to sharpen their tools, as it were. So these are all conversations we're having across the entire system of higher education, and the state's relationship through the HEC relative to measuring that success is going to be important going forward. We are currently engaged in collaborative work with the institutions on exactly that issue. How do we best measure the financial success of the institutions? And so the CFI model has been around since 1980. It's not new. It's used by others to look at institutions. And so, but we do know, and the federal government uses it as well, as you do the regional accrediting folks. But we know that there could be better metrics out there, and I am personally engaged in that work right now with a number of not just stakeholders in Oregon, but a number of national practitioners as well, on having that conversation about how do we best measure the institutions. And policy-wise, that'll be a conversation we have with the state and the state legislature about what's the state's role in ensuring the institution's ability, again, to support the educational experience for Oregonians. So it's an interesting conversation to have.
Absolutely. Dollars, cents, metrics aside, though, I mean, Ryan was talking about he liked when there was a chancellor and you know, unsaid, but you know, it was a fact. There was also a state board of higher education, not quite the same role as the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So those metrics aside, how does HEC communicate the values of the legislature and the state of Oregon back to the institutions?
We do that very deliberately through the formula. The formula is nothing more than an expression of what the state values, and the formula is used to distribute in the current biennium the $863 million that was appropriated for the public universities in this state. And so when we distribute that $863 million, that process then, in essence, is an expression of what the state hopes the institutions will help us achieve, which is more completions, students who are better prepared for tomorrow's workforce.
Does HEC have a mission statement independent of the seven schools?
We do. In fact, we are right now engaged in a strategic review of what we hope will become a, we're calling it the roadmap for the future of higher education in Oregon. And so we're working with stakeholders all across the state. We've had so far over 1,600 Oregonians participate and inform this vision. In fact, next Tuesday we have another step in that process where we're meeting with 65 to 70 different stakeholders from across the state. Because of recent events, it's going to be entirely online. And our website includes the opportunity for any citizen to get involved in that process. But we're really looking to create a true roadmap for the future of higher education. And so our mission statement aside, what we're really after is a roadmap for the entire state and all of its stakeholders as we look forward to a more prosperous future.
Nathan Graw at Carleton College, we've been talking about the demographics and the birth dearth coming out of the Great Recession and in the years since. I mean, obviously, it's not just people between the ages of 18 and 25 who go to college. So, I mean, is this where higher education needs to focus in order to stay viable in the years to come, particularly in smaller schools?
I think there are two places that have been mentioned in today's conversation. Yeah, the adult learner population is an important part of higher education already, disproportionately at state institutions, and it seems like that might be a place where renewed effort might yield some really good returns. That we know, as Jim mentioned, that people are going to need to retool, and universities can be prepared to teach those adult students. The other place where we can find new enrollments without finding new young prospective students is through attention to retention and student success, that if we are better serving our students so that they go through and persist to completion, we can get more enrollments out of each student that we recruit.
Linda Schott, what would you like to see happen that hasn't happened thus far in your time in Oregon in terms of support for the schools? It was pointed out in the university evaluation of SOU that because of lack of state support, that SOU has been forced to increase tuition, undergraduate tuition and fees, 83.3% in the last 10 years. So you could certainly use some more money from the state, but it hasn't been happening.
I believe that the state needs to focus a bit more on regional missions. I don't think it's fair that because of the way the formula is currently structured, SOU has had to increase the cost of education to students and families. 60% of our students and families are here in Southern Oregon. So it means that we've had to increase the cost for people in this region. For many individuals, we are the only educational option in this region. And I'd like to see the state be a little more aware of how to provide that equity. I think the stabilization funds that I spoke about earlier would enable that and allow us then to do the good work around student completion that the HEC would like for us to do and that we want to do. You know, I think part of what bothers me about the current formula is it has implicit in it the notion that we as educators do what will bring us money. And I think everyone on our campus knows we're here to educate students because we care about students, we care about them and their families and our communities. We don't educate students differently depending on whether they're a STEM major or a humanities major. We treat them all the same and try to do the best we can for them.
Is there a disconnect, President Schott? I mean, it's interesting. We talk so much about STEM stuff, but then when I talk to people who talk about the future of jobs in America, they say the jobs that robots can't replace are the kinds that require human skills, real interpersonal skills.
Exactly, Jeff. In a couple of years, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission hired Echo Northwest to do a talent assessment for the state of Oregon. And the final conclusion of that report was that we needed humans to become even better humans. And we believe that the kinds of coursework that we offer and our new strategic plan, which has a clear focus on creativity and innovation, is providing exactly that kind of preparation for students.
Nathan Graw, I guess we have the last minute for you. I just want to know if you think there's going to be a bit more of a shakeout if what we saw in Portland with Concordia University announcing its shutdown within 2 years of the time that Merrillhurst University shut down. Are we going to see further shakeouts, and how deep could it get?
Yeah, I think many higher education leaders suspect that there are going to be more institutions that will close because we've seen in the past already that there are institutions that are financial duress. A lot of them are out east where the density of institutions is particularly great. Exactly how many will close is a function in part of who closes and how institutions adapt. I'm a little bit more optimistic than some others that we can find new ways to meet student needs. We can retain our students better and find our way through this. But it will take work.
A lot of work and a lot more left to be done, obviously, ahead of us here. So not going to solve it here in this hour today, but we've had a chance to get a look at least at the picture of students and money in higher education or the lack thereof. Nathan Graw is a professor in the social sciences and professor of economics at Carleton College in Minnesota. He wrote the 2018 book, Demographics and the Demand for Higher Education. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jim Pinkert is the director of the Office of Post-Secondary Finance and Capital for Oregon's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, or HEC. Jim, thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
And Southern Oregon University President Linda Schott has joined us as well. President Schott, good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
All right. Take it easy.